Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namaste Sarasvata Deva Gauravani Pracharane Nirva Sresha Sunyavadi Pasatkare Sitarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sarasvita Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Bring from Candleton, chapter 16, verse 31. Krishnasya garba jagato ati bara avasannam parshni prahara parirugna fana atapatram adrisvahim adyam upasedur amusha patnya arta slathad avasana bhushana kesha banda krishnasya garbha jagato ti bharavasannam Parshni prahara parirugna fanata patram. Jisvahim adyam upase duramusha patnya. Arta slatad vasana bhushana kesha bandha. Garba, in whose abdomen Jagata is found the entire universe. Ati bara, by the extreme weight of Vasannam, fatigued, Parshni, of his heels, Prahara, by the striking, Parirugna, shattered, Fana, hoods, atapatram, umbrellas, drishva, seeing, ahim, serpent, adyam, primeval lord, upasedhu, approached, amushya, of kalia, patnya, the wives, artha, feeling distressed, slatat, disarrayed, vasana, clothing, bhushana, ornaments, kesha banda, locks of hair. Translation, when Kaliya's wives saw how the serpent had become so fatigued from the excessive weight of Lord Krishna, who carries the entire universe in his abdomen, and how Kaliya's umbrella-like hoods had been shattered by the striking of Krishna's heels, they felt great distress. With their clothing, ornaments, and hair scattered in disarray, they then approached the Eternal Personality of Godhead. Purport according to Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, Kaliya's wives had been disgusted with their husband because of his demoniac activities. They had been thinking, if this atheist is killed by the punishment of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then let him be killed. We'll become widows and engage in the worship of the Supreme Lord. But then the ladies noticed Kaliya's facial expression of the bodily features, and they understood that Kaliya had indeed taken shelter of the Lord within his mind. Seeing that he was manifesting symptoms of humility, remorse, regret, and doubt, they thought, just see how fortunate we are. Our husband has now become a Vaishnava. Therefore, we must now endeavor to protect him. They felt affection for their repentant husband, and severe distress because of his miserable position, and thus altogether they went into the presence of the Supreme Lord. Text 32, their minds very much disturbed those saintly ladies, placed their children before them, and then bowed down to the Lord of all creatures, laying their bodies flat upon the ground. They desired the liberation of their sinful husband and the shelter of the Supreme Lord, the giver of ultimate shelter, and thus they folded their hands in supplication and approached him. The wives of the Kaliya serpent said, "The punishment this offender has been subjected to is certainly just. After all, you have incarnated within this world to curb down envious and cruel persons. You are so impartial that you look equally upon your enemies and your own sons. For when you impose a punishment on a living being, you know it to be for his ultimate benefit. What you have done here is actually mercy for us, since the punishment you give to the wicked certainly drives away all their contamination. Indeed, because this conditioned soul, our husband, is so sinful that he has assumed the body of a serpent, your anger towards him is obviously to be understood as your mercy." Prabhupada Srila Madhvacharya points out in this connection that when a pious person suffers in this world, he realizes the punishment the Supreme Lord is meting out to me is actually his causeless mercy. Envious persons, however, even after being punished by the Lord for their purification, continue to envy him and to be resentful, and this attitude is a reason for the continued failure to understand the absolute truth. Translation: when Kaliya's wives saw how the serpent had become so fatigued from the excessive weight of Lord Krishna, who carries the entire universe in his abdomen, and how Kaliya's umbrella-like hoods had been shattered by the striking of Krishna's heels, they felt great distress. With their clothing, ornaments, and hair scattered in disarray, they then approached the eternal personality of Godhead. And we see there is a difference here between Kaliya's wives and Kaliya. Kaliya was a big demon, but by good fortune, his wives had respect for the Supreme Lord, and they actually didn't like their husband. So it's explained by Vishwanath Chakravarti in the purport. Actually, they thought, this would be good if Kaliya gets killed by Krishna. Then we won't have this demon for a husband anymore. And we can simply practice our Krishna consciousness very nicely. However, we see that there's a whole long prayer here, a very famous prayer of the wives of Kaliya, pleading to Krishna for mercy, for not themselves, but for their husband. So they also had great compassion. They were not hard-hearted persons, but they understood that Kali was a demon also, and they were not unrealistic. And therefore, if he died, it was no loss for them. But they also noticed that because of the mercy of Krishna, and of course Krishna subjugating this big demon, that he did show at the end, as in the previous verses said, he actually surrendered to the Lord. So they noticed that little bit of surrender in Kaliya. And therefore, they became very compassionate towards him because his attitude had changed. In other words, he would become a little bit of a Vaishnava. So therefore, they changed their mind, and instead of condemning him, they asked the Lord for mercy. Now, of course, already Krishna gave mercy to Kaliya. Because we see that he actually didn't kill him. Rather, he made him become humble. And in that process, then he surrendered. So Krishna himself was very merciful to Kaliya. And the wives of Kaliya also, we see, are showing great compassion for him. And this gives them an opportunity to approach the Lord directly and offer prayers. So in this way, they derive benefit also from this by glorifying the Lord. So here it is mentioned that Krishna was very, very heavy. And because of that, Kaliya was suffering. But of course, we can also see that Krishna was just a small child. So how could he be heavy? So from Mother Yasoda, Krishna is not heavy. Krishna can lift Mother Yasoda can lift Krishna and put him on her lap and feed him milk or throw him in the air and play with him and whatever. So for the devotee, Krishna can be very, very light. Huh? But for the demon, on the other hand, he can become impossibly heavy. Huh? So that was the case with Trinavarta. Trinavarta was a big demon and pulled Krishna up in the air, and he thought, I will kill Krishna, I will throw him up in the air, pull him up in the air, and then I'll drop him on the ground, and then he'll be killed. It was his Kamsa's order. However, when Trinavarta took Krishna up in the air and tried to drop him, Krishna wouldn't let go of him. He couldn't. Krishna's grip was so strong around his neck that the demon could do nothing. And Krishna was still acting like a small child, as if he were afraid. So he's holding on like this. But Trinavarta was trying to get rid of him, because suddenly Krishna became heavy. And he was so heavy that Trinavarta could, with all of his energy, could not keep him up there, and he couldn't keep himself up because Krishna was holding on to him. And Trinavarta began falling down again also. So Krishna manifested great heaviness there. Of course, we can see that even yogis can become heavier than the heaviest and bigger than the biggest and small than the smallest. So that's one thing. But these great demons also have powers like that. Great strength and powers. However, Krishna was heavier and stronger than whatever powers Trinavarta had, and he fell. So here again, Krishna becomes very, very heavy. But the reason is given. Krishna is heavy because actually he can hold the whole universe within him. And he has. Everything is within Krishna, so he's heavier than the heaviest. He's everything combined plus something extra. The whole universe is weight. So anybody in the universe must be lighter and not as strong. So that weight of the whole universe, not just one universe, of course, but all universes reside within the Supreme Lord. So he is, of course, everything in Prakriti, plus he's beyond Prakriti. Everything is within him. So therefore, if Krishna wants to show his weight, nobody can counter that. Nobody can counteract that. So here it says, Garbha Jagata, within his stomach exists the universe. And therefore, he is very, very heavy if he wants to be. And for the demons, he can do that. He can show this. And simultaneously, the world is within him, but at the same time, the world is not in Krishna. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, everything is in me, but everything is not in me also. So therefore, Krishna can also be very, very light. Simultaneously, it can be two things. So in this way, we cannot conceive of Krishna by ordinary logic. He can be opposites. And he shows this often in his pastimes. So in this way, everything is in him. Now, of course, we see that with he literally shows this also. Everything is in me. He showed it to Arjuna in the universal form. Everything was in Krishna, within him. And we see with Mother Yasoda, he also showed that. Everything, Mother Yasoda looked in his mouth and she saw all the universe there also. So Krishna can not only be heavier than the heaviest, he can show also that universe within him. How everything is in him, visibly. That is his great power. It is not simply a what we call a metaphor. It's not simply a metaphor. It can act like a metaphor, definitely. Yes, Krishna is heavier than anything, so he that means he's greater than anything. But if Krishna wants, he can show, yes, I am. Everything is in me. The universe is in my stomach. He can literally show that also. So nothing is impossible for the Lord. Now, of course, we can say the universe is so big and Krishna is so small. How can that be? How can we fit the biggest universe, which is so many billions of miles across, within Krishna, and Krishna's only this big? How is it possible? It's no problem for Krishna. He can do that. In fact, simultaneously, the universe can be inside Krishna and outside Krishna, which is also impossible for us to understand because how, you know, objects are in one place only at one time. But here they're inside and outside the universe. And Krishna showed that to Mother Yasoda. Universe was inside Krishna. Universe was outside Krishna. Same one. Same universe. And Mother Yasoda saw both things at the same time. This is inconceivable potency of the Supreme Lord. He can do what is impossible for other persons, because he's Supreme Lord. So it is nothing if he wants to manifest the universe or millions of universes within him. And by when Amsa of his power, he can manifest all of this. So if he wants, he can kill the demon immediately. But for showing pastimes, for giving joy to his devotees, giving relief to the devotees, saving from the harassment of Kaliya, and for the showing mercy to Kaliya, Krishna displays himself in this way and becomes heavier and heavier and dances on the hoods of Kaliya. So by the weight of Krishna, who looked very small but actually became very heavy, Kaliya became defeated. Now, of course, Kaliya, it's not just the weight of Kaliya. Kaliya tried to shake him off, but Krishna kept jumping around on his head, and he couldn't do that either. And not only Krishna jumped around, he jumped so skillfully that he could dance at the same time as Kaliya was moving his head and trying to shake him away. Still, Krishna could stand on top of his head and jump and dance and show all sorts of graceful movements. And in the meantime, by hitting Kaliya on the head with his feet, that added extra pain to Kaliya. So his dancing was very graceful. Simultaneously, it was a big kick on Kaliya's head. So in this way, he became very, very, he became shattered by all of this. So just as Krishna showed his great strength of his little foot to Sakatasura by kicking the cart and the whole demon died. So the same little foot dancing on top of Kaliya can be the most painful for the demon, even though it is very, very wonderful. And the gopis, they pray to Krishna that we just simply want to hold on our breast your soft lotus feet. So they're softer than the softest, but at the same time, and they're thinking that our hard breasts are going to damage your lotus feet when we hold them. But simultaneously, when Krishna jumps on Kaliya, they become very, very strong, and they're able to crush Kaliya. So in this way, Krishna has remarkable qualities and remarkable powers, some of which appear contradictory, but nothing is contradictory in the Lord. So we say he has inconceivable potency to reconcile opposites. Opposites can exist within the Lord. So in this way, Krishna showed his potencies very great. And Kaliya understood those potencies because he was the subject of defeat. He became defeated by Krishna. So he understood the great powers of the Supreme Lord. So Kaliya understands when he is defeated that Krishna is Supreme Lord. He is something extraordinary, very, very extraordinary. Now the residents of Vrindavan, when they see Krishna dance on Kaliya, they become very joyful, but they don't see him as Supreme Lord. They may have ideas, oh, he's very, very wonderful and powerful, but they won't see him as Supreme Lord. They say, this is wonderful, how this small child is defeating this demon. But they don't think of him as Supreme Lord. Now the wives of Kaliya, of course, they're also addressing him actually as Supreme Lord. And they understand that he has great powers and that Kaliya has surrendered to the Supreme Lord. So they have this understanding. They are not residents of Vrindavan. So their attraction to Krishna is a little different. So they can accommodate Krishna as Supreme Lord. And therefore their prayers are like this. They're offering respects to the Supreme Lord. We will never see the Brajavasis doing this. Oh, Krishna, you are Supreme Lord like that. Of course, sometimes you'll see the gopis. They do say, you are Paramatma something when they're in great distress. So it is understood that they do have some sort of understanding like that, but it is very temporary, and then it disappears when their distress is gone. And some sort of manifestation and distress, they think of as Supreme Lord. But then when that distress goes away again, they forget about that completely. However, others, like the wives of Kaliya, they understand that Krishna is Supreme Lord. And they say here that, yes, you've come to this material world in order to curb the envious and the cruel persons. In other words, they, like the devas, they can understand the mission of Krishna coming in the world and incarnating, etc. Now, what they say is very important. They say, you have actually very merciful to us. Merciful to Kaliya and merciful to the wives of Kaliya. Even though by defeating Kaliya, Kaliya gets pain, and even though the wives are put into distress by seeing their husband getting defeated and suffering. But they say, this is all your mercy. Krishna, this is all your mercy. So this is actually a very advanced state. If one can come to that realization that all one's suffering is Krishna's mercy, this is actually a good qualification for getting Krishna's mercy. If we understand that even the suffering he gives us is mercy, then we become qualified for Krishna's mercy. And actually this has been stated in the previous chapter, the prayers of Lord Brahma. There he says that when I experience, or when anyone experiences suffering in this world, then we look at it as anukampa, or mercy. And we also realize that it is atma kritam, which means self-inflicted, self-produced. We do not blame the Lord. Oh Lord, why are you giving me this karma? Oh Lord, why are you being so cruel to us and making us have earthquakes and tsunami waves and famines and whatever diseases and whatever individual afflictions? They never think like that. It's all self-created suffering. In other words, they accept the law of karma as a just law. Whereas the non-believers will never accept the law of karma, first of all, or that they deserve what they're getting in this world. They will never accept that. And they will use that excuse to therefore say, God cannot exist. Because if he exists, he would be very kind to me. And he's given me suffering, therefore he cannot exist. How can there be such a cruel God? If he's a cruel God, we don't want that type of God. So therefore, God doesn't exist. So this is a main factor for the atheistic belief. We are suffering, therefore there cannot be a God. And if they enjoy, then still there is no God. But the suffering gives them a chance to make this an excuse for the rationale for them that God does not exist. And if there is happiness, it is self-created. If there's suffering, they blame God. And therefore, God is no good. We won't worship him. So, this is the mentality of people in the material world. And it is not superficial. It is very deep. Very, very deep within the jiva. In fact, it is so deep that it will continue for billions and billions and billions and billions of lifetimes. It will go on for the whole of Brahma's life, and jivas will sit here in the material world with that conception from beginning of Brahma's life to end of Brahma's life. And then they'll go into Mahavishnu, and they'll rest for some time, and they'll come out again, and they'll start all over again for another Brahma's 100 years. And they'll go through millions of births like that again. And then they'll go back into Pralaya and sit in Mahavishnu for some time, and they'll come out again, and they'll do the same thing. So that's a long, long time. One day of Brahma is what, 4 billion years? Like approximately 4 billion years, like that. Times 365 times 100. So that's one Brahma's life. So you can go through many, many lifetimes in one lifetime of Brahma. And you won't change. Most of the jivas don't change. It's not that half get liberated or 25% get liberated. The quantity is very, very small. And the living energies are wandering around in different species blindly and aimlessly. They go up and they go down, they go up and they go down, they go up and they go down. That's why Lord Chaitanya says they are wandering in the universe. Brahmatik kon bhagyavan ajeev. And then by great mercy, somehow our great good fortune and mercy of devotee in Krishna, then bhakti, lata bij is planted, the seed of bhakti is given to them, and it grows. But until they get that mercy, you simply wander in the material world with this conception. I want to enjoy, and I will strive to enjoy in this material world with whatever body I have. And we don't regard anybody else as very important at all. Give no respect to God. Yeah, so that is the atheistic mentality. So when we become a devotee and then we actually accept responsibility for our suffering, that is a big step. I mentioned before that suffering is actually a major cause for people surrendering, and in the case of Kaliya, definitely. If he didn't get the suffering, he would never surrender. And when he's directly chastised by the Lord and he was suffering, then he surrendered. So when we do experience suffering in this world, we can do two things. We can become hostile to the Lord. I said, Lord cannot exist because I'm suffering. Or we can do the opposite and take it as the Lord's mercy. But to take it as the Lord's mercy is a very difficult step. Very, very difficult step for us to take. To say that we did this. It's our fault, not Krishna's, not anybody else's fault. It's self-inflicted. I did this. I've created this situation for myself. We don't want to think like that. We don't want to put responsibility on ourselves for our actions and our problems. So to do that it takes great maturity. So Krishna's plan is that he has this law of karma there to create that realization. Yes, it is self-inflicted. And we learn by going through different acts what the results are, and therefore we learn not to do some things and learn to do other things. This is a common experience anyway in the material world. That's how we learn anything. If you learn fire is hot by getting burned, then you avoid putting your hand in the fire again. And that's how children learn. Sometimes they don't want to learn. They play with the fire, and then they get their hand burned, and then they'll learn. That's very, very painful. So many things are like that in this world for the jiva. Unfortunately, that's one of the only processes that works, and even that takes a long time to work in many cases. So you throw the prisoner in jail and he comes out and commits more crimes. And you could do that a long time and still he won't rectify himself. You won't think that the prison is so bad after all. Because the desire for enjoyment is so strong. So this is the whole process of karma to make us learn something. We get immediate results sometimes, and we get, well, of course, always we get some immediate result. It's either success or failure for our act, and then we get enjoyment or suffering for that. But we also get the long-term results. Two results are there. And in this way, results follow us. The karma follows us from birth to birth. So that we get more than one chance. So that we get more than one learning experience. And therefore the experiences of last time and previous lifetime and previous lifetime, they can all be taken into account in this lifetime. We can learn from them also. But the problem is most people don't learn. And every time they get the suffering, they think somebody else is doing this, not me. So it takes a long time to come to that realization. It's like the prisoner in the jail. He will think it's not my fault. He'll blame everybody else for his situation. The government is bad, the policemen are bad, this person's bad, that person's bad, they're all crazy. I did the right thing. Whatever. And they won't put any responsibility on themselves. When you do, then this is the cure is possible. When you do think that I have some responsibility and I'm part of the problem, then you can begin to change, then you can begin to come to a solution. But until then, where there's no sense of responsibility, then it's hopeless. So the law of karma is for that. So that is mercy of the Lord. That is the first step in mercy. The Lord does not show direct mercy and come down personally and say, oh, I'll be merciful to you, in most cases, except in Putana and exceptional cases he does that when he incarnates, etc. And for rare individuals, even when he doesn't incarnate, he'll come and be merciful to them. But normally, no.
The mercy for all the jivas of the material world is the karma. That's his form of mercy. And it's a very just law. His mercy is not, it's not that he will change the law for one person and not another person. The law is very just. But this is the form of mercy for most people because they're at such a low level. They can only learn gradually after millions and millions of lifetimes by this getting this discomfort and pain in the material world. They'll learn not to do it. Long process. Very, very long process. So we could say the jivas are very slow learners because of that very strong desire to get the enjoyment. That's why they don't learn. They refuse to take the lesson and still want to enjoy the material world. So they get birth after birth after birth. Which Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Icha Dvesha Samuttena. Driven by desire and hatred. We become bewildered in this world and we get pushed into body after body because of this. Under complete illusion. The only impetus is desire and hatred. And actually the hatred is actually another aspect of desire. I like this, I want this, I will act to get this, and I get karma. And what do I dislike? Everything that prevents me from getting that desire fulfilled. That's all. So desire and hatred are the same thing ultimately. Two aspects of the same thing. And this is what pushes the jiva in the material world to do activities. To get what he wants and do all sorts of sinful activities to get it. Or to show hatred and violence against those who prevent it from getting it and committing more sinful activity in that process. So in other words, it's a type of violence, Icha Dvesha, impels the jiva to commit violence against other living entities, either as an incidental thing or as a willful thing, through the dvesha or the anger and hatred. So it is difficult for the jiva to learn. Not impossible, but difficult. It's a long process. And therefore we have this gradual elevation of jivas where they can't even do anything from the plant to the animal to the human being. And when you're a human being, then gradual process in Varnashram, if we're lucky to be in Varnashram, gradual process after many births from Sudra to Vaishya to Kshatriya to Brahmana, many, many births. And going through Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Astanga Yoga, and then to Bhakti Yoga. A very, very gradual process, many, many lifetimes. So that is the gradual process. But Krishna is also very merciful, and he has the quick process as well. And that is the process of bhakti. So somehow or other, you get that seed of bhakti, you can very quickly advance. And then you don't have to go through the gradual process. Of course, we can say that probably you get the seed of bhakti because you've gone gradually, at least to some stage previously. You got to a certain stage. When you get the seed of bhakti, then you can develop very, very quickly. So anyway, it is a long process, a long, drawn-out process to recognize the mercy that the Lord is giving. And when we do, then we get the mercy. First we have to take responsibility and understand that we did everything and that all the laws of God are for us, for our advancement, not for harassing us. And therefore it says atmakritam vipakam, that all my suffering is self-created and the Lord operates the law of karma as an act of mercy upon me by which I should learn. And if I learn, then I can advance. So this is the Lord's mercy. It is free educational system, we could say. Well, we don't like it because it causes pain to us. But nevertheless, it's his system. And it's a perfect system. Nobody can escape it. We can try to fool everybody. You cannot fool the law of karma. And we cannot escape it. Those reactions will go with us and follow us birth after birth after birth after birth in our subtle body. Our subtle body follows us birth after birth, and our karmas in the subtle body will follow us birth after birth also. We can't escape them. We have to get them. And so it's inevitable, and it's equal, and it's just. And the whole thing is to educate us and give us some realization of our responsibility in the world, and to very carefully consider what is our goal, and what activity is the proper activity to do in any situation with consideration. So in other words, the jiva has to become a little philosophical and get some knowledge and not impulsively act in this world. And so that is the mercy of the karma. That's what it's supposed to do for us and help us achieve that platform. So anyway, when one accepts that position of yes, this is all mercy upon me, even my suffering is mercy, what to speak of the good things, the punyas, that we understand the law of karma, that is one stage, but that's not complete. That's stage one. Stage two is that we actually positively worship the Lord. Not simply we accept our suffering with this mercy, but we continue to serve the Lord with body, mind, and words. And we never give up that act, those acts. So we accept the suffering and whatever that's going on in the material world is mercy, and we learn from it that we should refrain from those things. In other words, we have proper conduct in the material world. But as far as relationship with the Supreme Lord goes, then we serve the Lord also simultaneously. And that combination is such that the Lord shows mercy. We become daya bak. A bak is a legal inheritor. Just as the son or the daughter is the inheritor of the property of the parents, whatever. They have a claim to the property. So if one has this attitude of understanding the mercy of the Lord and accepting one's position and serving the Lord in spite of all the problems, then one becomes daya bak. One becomes rightful claimant of Krishna's mercy. Which means that Krishna is very willing to give his mercy to such persons who are mature and responsible and steady in their faith with the Lord. The Lord becomes very attracted to those persons, and then he gives great mercy to them. So this is the attitude in which the devotee has to operate in devotional service. So it takes great faith and all these qualities like tolerance and forgiveness and many, many other factors are there. But basically all revolves around accepting the will of the Lord. Everything, the Lord is perfect and everything he does is perfect, so therefore whatever position I'm in is somehow the Lord's mercy and we should accept it and try to figure out how it is mercy. So it depends on the faith of the individual. When he has that strong faith, and in spite of all the difficulties and experiences of the world, he does not doubt and he holds his faith and he continues to develop his relationship with the Lord in love, then the Lord is very, very pleased with that. In other words, it's a type of purification for the jiva. And in this process, he gives up all the anarthas, etc., obstacles. So in proportion to the surrender of the jiva, then Krishna shows his mercy. So this means that one comes to this position of understanding the mercy of the Lord and the karma, etc. It means one's advancing in devotional service. Our faith is at a very strong level. So when we show anger and all these emotions, and that is simply a frustration for our own desires. But we see the Lord can show anger also, but it is not the same anger. So in this verse 34 it says that you are also angry, but that anger is actually your mercy as well. It is not the same as our anger. Our anger is simply frustration. The Lord's anger is a show of mercy upon Kaliya. And by that appearance of anger, Kaliya is able to change. So the Lord's anger is different from ours. Ours is, creates bondage for us in the material world. The Lord's anger is such that is wonderful. And a devotee gets out of the material world by the show of anger, as in the case of Kaliya. So the effects of whatever Krishna does is different from what the jivas manifest in this world. Okay.
The killing of Adam in relation to the Zen thing, can you please explain how we can't approach the mind until that slaughter stops?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is one element. It's not the only element. We get many vegetarians who do not become devotees of the Lord and will never attain the Lord also. So it is one aspect, but it's not the only aspect. Eh? In fact, we say secondary in one way. Eh? But also, if, at the same time, if you don't do that, you cannot approach the Lord. So, but it's not that if you only do this, you get the Lord also. It doesn't mean that. Eh? So in the Varnashram system, one can be a Brahmin and not attain the Lord also by following his orders and being vegetarian or whatever. You don't necessarily become a Vaishnava after becoming a Brahmana, only if you get mercy. Huh? So it is one important qualification, but there's even more important things that are necessary. Huh? So why it is important is because this is again the law of karma, involves the law of karma. And if sin and violence and killing animals and plants and human beings and whatever, why we want to kill? Basically, again, it is personal interest, me over everybody else. And so this simply enforces our sense of ignorance and false ego and desire and selfishness. So bhakti is the opposite. Bhakti is we have to give everything to the Lord. No selfishness. Any abhilashita shunya. Only the Lord. So you're going opposite directions, more or less. Sense gratification, all karma, everything going one direction. Surrender to the Lord another direction. So if you want to go this way, you can't go this way. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So he has strong tendencies this way, not very conducive for bhakti. Nevertheless, a person in that situation, if somehow or other he has faith, he becomes qualified. In spite of the fact he's very sinful or whatever, like Murgari the hunter, and he was killing the animals and watching them suffer and die. Yeah? But he got faith by the mercy of Narada Muni. Somehow or other, he was a little respectful to him, and then he began to listen to him. He got a little faith, and then he said, okay, what should I do? And then Narada Muni gave him instructions, and he followed the instructions because of that faith in Narada Muni. He got mercy, and so he could advance. But he gave up. He said, drop your bow. I'll speak to you, but drop your bow and arrow. So if you want to do both, it is not possible. If you want to continue both, no. If you've done it, fine. But if you want to give it up and then do this, we can do that. But if you want to do both simultaneously, do all the sinful activity and also surrender to Krishna, impossible. Mm-hmm. You can't go west and east at the same time. Huh? So you can go gradually, of course. And Krishna also admits that, okay, we can't expect complete surrender immediately. So the process of sadhana bhakti is the gradual process in which gradually you give up your bad activities. And in the process, you may come back and do another bad activity, and Krishna doesn't mind that as long as you're still progressing and you limit that. So therefore, he says, apichet sudaracharo. Huh? Even if you're the most sinful act and you've done the most bad act of sin, you're still my devotee. But it doesn't mean you do it all the time. It's accidental. Or says one time or whatever. But if you keep doing it like that, it's hopeless. Hmm? But if it's one time, fine, and then you repent and you correct yourself, fine, then Krishna doesn't take that too much and too seriously.
Hmm? You're saying before responsibility. When we come to the realization that we are eternal spirits of, and that we have been neglecting Krishna for so long, surely that should lead us to take responsibility for not just our actions in this life, but for our eternal life.
Yeah.
That should make us very humble.
Yeah.
That should put us in a position where we really beg Krishna for forgiveness when we come to the realization that, as you say, all the things that are happening to us now is Krishna's mercy to bring us to the understanding.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is very gentle, and he arranges things that we have wonderful people like yourself to bring us to understanding when we have problems.
Yeah.
The Srimad Bhagavatam is to turn to.
Yeah.
So surely when we take responsibility for all our actions, that should lead us to great humility.
It does, definitely.
Yeah, because we realize that we haven't just been sinful in this life.
Yeah.
We've actually completely neglected Krishna.
Billions and billions and billions of lifetimes. Completely the opposite.
Exactly.
Hostile.
Lifetime after lifetime.
Yeah.
So that should lead us to lots of humility, which should lead us to great faith.
Yeah.
And give us the ability to accept the responsibility of those actions.
Yeah.
Which hopefully, as you say, will stop driving us Wednesday.
But the only problem is to get that realization. Most Jivas can't do that. Therefore, they keep getting the pain and the suffering.
Reminding ourselves every time we have a problem that we have to search for the answer. Krishna has given us this so we can learn a lesson.
True.
Because as serenity promises, he'll bring us to the understanding by which we can come to him. So we have to try and understand what understanding we need to be looking for.
Yeah. Every situation there is a chance to learn, obviously. Yeah? And we should learn from our mistakes.
We're taking responsibility for so many of them.
I have a question, because you're talking about the way that the world, the universe is set up, is kind of a learning experience in terms of karma.
Yeah.
And then you'd assume that also people have to hear from scripture, so they can say, oh, this is happening because of my activity, so that's a bit of faith in that. But I was sort of curious about how the Lord sets up an ashram dharma, and he gives the Vedas like with crude activities and that, like is that also, I'm just a bit confused about it, because like he gives that, and then it's like on one hand it's like they can have sense enjoyment that's regulated, so they have their desires, but it's regulated, and then they're gradually elevated within that, except in the Bhagavad Gita he also says those who hold to this system just achieve repeated birth and death.
So what happens is, this is one part of this. It's not the complete system, in other words. So if you get stuck in the system and you go step A and stay step B, but you don't go to step C, then it's a failure again. So you got to go through the whole system. So if you're going to do the Varnashram system, you start at the bottom but realize there's a top also, and not get stuck in the system and simply get stuck in karma and go to Svargaloka and come back and go to Svargaloka again and come back. You should understand you should go beyond that. But the problem is, once you get in there and you get those pleasures of Svargaloka, you don't want to get out. So that's a problem. And so Krishna says, you better just do bhakti and not go through the gradual system. And then that way, you know, you can get out quicker. And it's also, the other process takes a long time to go through.
It looks controversial, because everywhere is said you cannot approach Krishna directly. And how in Nalpatni they approach Krishna directly?
How's that? How?
Narpatni have the wife of Kali, twice of Kali approached.
Well, this is, of course, Krishna Leela, in when Krishna comes to the material world, and obviously people have to, asuras are all going to contact him directly if they fight with him. Huh? So when Krishna performs his pastimes, it's a little different. Huh? Of course, we can also understand that it's not that independently the wives of Kali approached Krishna and suddenly they got bhakti, because it is mentioned previously also they were also favorable to the Lord. So therefore we have to understand in previous lifetimes also they were devotional and they got mercy of the Lord, and gradually they somehow by their karma they got a bad husband, but by good fortune they got to see Krishna. Simultaneously they also surrendered in the process, because first they got a bad husband, and then they got, because of Kaliya, then they got Krishna to see Krishna, and through that they got to directly associate and praise Krishna and get his mercy.
The second point was, what was Kaliya in previous life?
I don't know about previous life, but it mentions here later about his previously in this life he was, you know, put there, and then the next what happened, then he had to leave the lake, but he wasn't killed. I don't know about previous life.
Might be a very, very demon.
Obviously demoniac.
Spitting poison. Old Yamuna River.
Yeah.
Killing me.
Another demon, of course.
Maharaj, most of the Indians, they believe like your astrological, like Shani, Rahu, Ketu, they are stronger, and because of those people you have hard time.
Yeah, but that again is simply symbolic or like representative. The planets are representative of devas, and devas are representative of simply carrying out the order of karma. Yeah? Planets, in other words, are in the sky, and planets are ruled by devas. The moon is ruled by Krishna, of course, and lesser by Indra. And the sun deva is there, and over him is Rama, etc., like that. So, if you commit offense against these deities by not worshipping them properly, or doing whatever, or by offending something related to them, like the sun is for the eye or whatever like that. So maybe you punch somebody in the eye in your last lifetime, then you have a problem in your eye in this lifetime. So it's the sun god that's going to take the responsibility for that, because the sun is in charge of the eye. In the body, the different organs have different planets attached to them. So therefore, it's not that the sun hates you or anything, but he's carrying out his function according to the law of karma, that you've done this, so therefore he has to perform his function of giving a particular punishment in that direction to make you correct yourself, like that. So again, it's they're not operating whimsically, the planets. It's only in relation to karmas that they show karma. And particularly Shani is the karma planet. And they're all planets of karma, but Shani particularly is the bad karmas.
You said the universe is inside Krishna, but also outside Krishna. Where is it when it's not in Krishna?
It's simultaneously.
So it is always in Krishna.
Yeah. That's what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. It's in me and it's outside me. And I'm in it, I'm not in it. Krishna is outside the universe, and everything is in the within Krishna, and Krishna is within the universe simultaneously. And Krishna is not, everything is not in Krishna simultaneously, and he's not in anything. Inconceivable potency of God. Of course, normally, when we talk about the Swarup of Krishna, we don't worship the universal form the same as we worship Shyamsundar form and Govinda and Narasimhadev. We don't take that in the same way. Why? It's because that form of the universe is directly, it's God's relation with the universe, which is a functional aspect. And the forms, other forms, are in the spiritual world. So there's a difference there. One is functional for manifestation and of the material world. But devotees in the spiritual world aren't interested in the material world anyway. So there's no concern for that form, only with that form. For people in the material world, our first approach to God is he's the creator of the world, etc., etc. You know, powerful figure like that. So it's something that the people of the material world can relate to. So therefore the universal form is put down on a lower scale than the eternal forms in the spiritual world. Even though it's a form of the Lord, it's not on the same level as the others. And therefore when Krishna tells Arjuna, I'll give you the eyes to see this Lord, this universal form, he says, I give you Divya Chakshu. So we can of course say Divya Chakshu means transcendental spiritual eyes. But Arjuna already had spiritual eyes. He's a Nityasiddha, and he sees Krishna directly. So why does he need more spiritual eyes? Is it higher vision to have the universal form vision than to see Krishna as your friend? No. So their Divya Chakshu means heavenly eyes, like the devas, which are lesser eyes. They can appreciate this form of the universal whatever. And Arjuna sees Krishna directly as friend, which is higher. So he gave him a lower vision, actually. Gave him a vision like the devas, who appreciate this wonderful form. That's what the Divya Chakshu there means. He gave him eyes of devas, not transcendental eyes. So he could appreciate that form. And then Krishna later, Arjuna said, I don't like that form anyway. Take it away. So then Krishna removed that vision, removed those eyes, and he got his normal eyes back. And he saw Krishna as his friend. Well, that not in Bhagavatam. I think Prabhupada mentioned that something like that. And I think they have a local legend, something like that, of snakes or something, whatever, like that. And in relation to that, then Prabhupada said, yes, and Kaliya came there. Because he was banished from Anjumon, he had to go somewhere else. But where it doesn't say Fiji, Bhagavatam. Well, they have a Kaliya deity there in the temple, actually, Krishna Kaliya in Fiji.
How much different is India today when I look at it in a map or an atlas as to what it was size-wise when Krishna was around having his pastime?
Well, that's also not mentioned. We assume it was approximately the same size or whatever, though we see that it's a little bit difficult to imagine how they could travel over one night. They would go from one place to the other in their chariots, but of course their chariots traveled faster like that. And Krishna would go out in the fields every day, walk out and come back, but then if we try to do that now, it takes a pretty long time to get from Vrindavan to Nandagram or from whatever like that to walk. You take half a day to get there. So it doesn't really mention like that. But of course, The Dhamma is a little different because the dimensions are not our dimensions also. And we have this external dimension, at which 64 crosses or whatever Vrindavan is, Brajamandala. But when you look at the descriptions of the pastimes, we cannot apply the same measures because the number of cows and the number of calves are like billions that Krishna goes out with every day. And the number of cowherd boys are billions. And the number of gopis are billions. So how do they fit in that one little place? Eh? More than the population of the whole world, I think, is in there. Sitting in And when Krishna had the Rasa Lila, there were 3 billion gopis there. And they formed a circle. And then Krishna expanded himself into 3 billion forms to be with each gopi. And they were all in a circle. So they make a line of a circle of 6 billion people, and it's going to be pretty big. But it all fit one little grove within Vrindavan, not just Mathura, but in one grove there within the Vrindavan area. One little grove, and they all fit in there. So the dimensions must be a little different, you say.
Well, I can assume something like that because they don't really look at the map in here in the last few hundred years. It's been chopped up and divided up.
Oh, yeah.
So I can just imagine that India would have been, and sometimes I imagine it must have been the whole world to have the time and space to have those activities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was all, the whole world was expanded. We don't know.
Maharaj, is Krishna Kaliya meeting the day of spiritual world also?
What's that? No, Kaliya's not there. No, Kaliya's spiritual world. Okay, Hare Krishna.